Good afternoon. My name is Erwin Glickus. I'm the publisher of the Free Press, which had the honor and the pleasure of publishing Judge Bork's book, The Tempting of America. It's that matter that gives me the pleasure and privilege of introducing him today. And it is a very special honor to introduce him to this group, which I think more than any other group one can imagine gathering in America this year will understand something very personally about the career of this book, about its publication, and about the experience of publishing it. I've had that sense both because your own Steve Calabresi and others have been such champions of the book, and your own relationship to the ideas that are in the book. Let me share with you some very good news, which is news to most of us. We have learned that tomorrow, the New York Times Book Review bestseller list will show The Tempting of America as having jumped from number 12 to number 4 nationally. I feel what you feel with that applause, you may believe. It is an extraordinary vindication of some ideas, a man, and a group who believe something about America today and the law. We've also been told that next week it will appear again as number 4, so that it is holding that position. It has become, in fact, a national phenomenon, a book of profound and complex intellectual reasoning, and it is number 4 in the United States bestseller list. There is a future for this country. By next week, the Free Press will have sold 170,000 copies of The Tempting of America, and more are on their way. In reaching that number, a number of other records were broken. Judge Bork did a series of visits to bookstores across the country, and in cities like Atlanta, Kansas City, Dallas, Chicago, Los Angeles. And after every one of them, I received what can only be described as an astounded phone call from the owner or manager of the bookstore saying that he had never seen anything like it. That the crowds and the enthusiasm and the warmth of the reception of the lines of people at the store was something he had never seen before, and that in each case, between 300 and 400 copies of the book were sold on the spot. In fact, all the books that the store had been cajoled into buying for the judge's appearance. And they regretted in one case, there was a bookstore that ran out to the Waldens across the mall and bought more copies. It's true. And the Waldens was nice enough to let them have them, too. One other bookstore, I think it was in Kansas City, called to tell us that in his memory, the only time he had seen crowds with such a heartfelt and deeply emotional response to an author was some years ago when Bob Hope had appeared. at his bookstore, in any case, it has been wonderful, and it isn't over yet, but the success of this book is only half the story. The publication of The Tempting of America did not begin in quite so promising a way, and I think there may be a story in that is to the point of your discussions this week. Initially, it took some hard pushing in places to get the first printing into stores at all. And some stores who had proved their devotion to the First Amendment by putting Salman Rushdie's satanic verses in their window initially refused to take any copies of The Tempting of America. two major book clubs, the Book of the Month Club and the Literary Guild, whose selections are regarded as by the industry and booksellers as early warning systems of success in the book industry, turned it down flat, not even selecting it as an alternate when we first presented it to them. And then, a few days before the publication of the book, NBC's Today Show suddenly and inexplicably canceled the judge's long-scheduled appearance to be interviewed about the publication of the book. In addition, at about that time, I was, as publishers do, talking to groups of booksellers and to book review editors about the main themes of the book, and the response was respectful but skeptical, and I came away in many cases with the distinct impression that they believed that the separation of powers was something that the judge had invented. At this point, which was early November, not all that long ago, the judge and I talked often on the phone. He was sincerely and characteristically worried about me and the Free Press. Would we be all right? We consoled each other with brave, good cheer, which lasted in each phone conversation until the phone conversation ended with mutual sighs. I did all I could to hide a sinking feeling that this very good man and brilliant writer and thinker was about to get treated badly and most unjustly once again. But that's not what happened. In retrospect, it is now clear that that early experience was another book industry, media, university culture phenomenon, analogous to the refrains of 1980 and 1984, and a story that Gordon Krovitz reminded me of only a little while ago, of the Yale School professor who said, "Not only don't I know anybody who voted for Ronald Reagan, I don't even know anyone who knows anyone who voted for Ronald Reagan." To which Gordon says, a freshman from Oklahoma piped up from the back of the room, "Here I am, sir." And it was. All of us freshmen from Oklahoma, or descendants and friends and others, who piped up and are being heard from now. And like Ronald Reagan in 84 and before, this is a book with a legacy and a future. Thanks to the tempting of America, the coherence and legitimacy of the original understanding in constitutional thought and judging is on the record again and on the national intellectual agenda with an unmistakable clarity and authority. Let me share with you a private fantasy which I've been living with and have never admitted to the judge until now. While he was writing this book, I began to understand where that clarity and authority about the Constitution, in fact, came from. While I watched his mind work, while I watched this completely dedicated and courteous and grumpy and very, very serious man at work in the writing of this book, I could not help from imagining him sitting among, writing, and working with a group of 18th century Americans in Philadelphia 200 years ago, reasoning his way with them toward the invention of a quite imperfect system of government that would, however, eventually prove itself to be the one for which the whole world would long and be willing to die to achieve. In our time, in truth, Robert Bork is once again for us an American founder, now reminding us, the American people, to preserve and sustain that glorious vision of man and civilization that still exists for our guidance in the Constitution of the United States. I give you quite proudly, Robert Bork.
You do warm my heart. I found Mr. Glickus as a publisher and editor because when I left the bench, I said, I called George Will and said, I know nothing about this industry. Where do I look? And he said, go wherever Irwin Glickus is. He's the best editor in America. And I found that to be true, particularly since he didn't edit heavily.
Where George feels.
But unlike a lot of other editors and publishers, he wanted a serious book about the philosophy of constitutional judging and not a book about the usual Washington book about how there were three of us in the room and I was the only honest man there. So I got to write the book I've been wanting to write for 15 years. And it does seem to be doing quite well, perhaps due to the 3.5 years, I think it was, I spent in the Senate hearing room. But I discovered I'm competing with books with names like Everything I Needed to Know I Learned in Kindergarten. And it was on fire when I lay down on it.
It's true.
But it's been an enormously enjoyable experience working with the Free Press, and in particular, working with Irwin Glickus, and I recommend it to you. And it's also enormously enjoyable once more among the friends of the Federalist Society. There is no more important movement in American law today than this society, which understands and battles for the idea that law is something more than politics. And that is an idea we have been in danger of losing, and you are helping to bring it back. Well, the subject of the book, of course, is the separation of powers. In that case, the tendency of the judiciary to invade the province of the legislature. But today I want to talk briefly about the health of the constitutional separation of powers in another area. And perhaps in no area is the separation of powers more threatened than in the conduct of foreign affairs, and more specifically, in the use of American force abroad. In this area, in recent years, Congress has become increasingly active and has tried to control the president's actions with respect to force with a degree of detail that cannot and has not produced vigorous or coherent policy. A prime example of that, of course, has been the vacillating and contradictory policy we followed with respect to the Contras in Nicaragua. More generally, there is the desire of Congress to make or to invoke law with respect to the use of American troops abroad. No nation is more devoted to the rule of law than is the United States. But there are areas of life, and the international use of armed force seems to me one of them, where the entire notion of law, that is, law conceived as a body of legal principles declared in advance to control decisions to use force, where that conception of law is out of place. Yet the pretense that there is such law and that it has been constantly violated has debilitating effects upon our foreign policy and upon the vigor of the presidency and the rightful place of the president in the conduct of our foreign affairs. Two examples of that come to mind. One is international law about the use of force, and the other is domestic law, that is the War Powers Act. These two spring from different sources, but they are alike in that they are not law in any recognizable sense, they are not enforceable, and their main use is as a weapon for those who think a policy, they don't like a policy, but for political reasons are afraid to criticize it. And so they claim that the action the president has taken, the invasion of Grenada, the support of the Contras, the attempt to rescue our hostages in Iran, the incursion in Panama, the bombing of Libya, the list goes on and on. They claim that those actions, not that they're not prudent, not that they're not moral, but that they are violations of law. And this tends to turn the debate from where it should be, whether an action was in our national interest and whether it was moral, to a debate about whether the president is a law violator. Legalisms displace moral discussion, and the president's position is weakened and Congress's position enhanced. Now, Senator Moynihan is the leading advocate in Congress of the view that there is a known body of international law that the president must obey. And for that reason, he said that our invasion of Grenada was illegal. Yet his own statements about international law are fatal to the notion that it is a known body of doctrine, and therefore that it condemns our actions in Grenada or more recently in Panama. Now, Senator Moynihan said this, I'm quoting him, "Manifestly, we cannot hold the rest of the world to a great many of the propositions relating to their internal conduct that we wrote into covenants and charters and declarations with such earnestness in the first half of this century. An ancient doctrine, going back at least to Grotius, is rebus sic stantibus, which denotes a tacit condition said to attach to all treaties that they shall cease to be obligatory as soon as the state of facts and conditions upon which they were founded has substantially changed. For all that Chapter 2 of the Charter of the Organization of the American States requires of members, quote, the effective exercise of representative democracy, close quote, this is not going to be the political norm of this hemisphere or this world during the foreseeable future. It had once looked that way. It no longer does. Circumstances have changed. What has not changed, what the United States must strive to make clear has not changed, I'm still quoting Senator Moynihan, is the first rule of international law, pacta sunt servanda, agreements must be kept. That immediately discloses the inconsistency within international law that prevents it from being law. If the condition upon which the United States agreed to the OAS Charter, that the members would be democracies, has changed, why does not rebus sic stantibus relieve us of the obligation to keep the rest of the agreement? Moynihan's argument lacks coherence. And I think that is why it is wrong to say that the invasion of Grenada or of Panama is a clear violation of international law. In both cases, the United States went in and restored democracy and freedom and removed a dictatorship. That was in our national interest. And so long as we think that freedom and democracy are better than tyranny, it was also a highly moral action. That should be good enough. The major difficulty with international law is that it converts what are essentially problems of international morality into arguments about law that are largely drained of morality. I once listened to a professor of international law defend our invasion of Grenada, and it seemed to me that his argument was tortured, and some of the most important considerations omitted. And I asked whether three factors that most Americans thought relevant counted in international law. First, the Grenadian government consisted of a minority that seized control by violence and maintained it by terror. Second, it was a Marxist-Leninist regime and represented a further advance in this hemisphere of a power that threatens freedom and democracy throughout the world. Finally, the people of Grenada were ecstatic at being relieved of tyranny and the ever-present threat of violence. This expert in international law replied, rather sadly, that none of those considerations had any weight in international law. Nor could they. International law has to be law acceptable to to nations with very different political moralities, which means it assumes moral equivalence, which we should never do. Much the same thing could be said of President Bush's forcible removal of General Noriega. It was in our national interest, and over 90% of the Panamanian people welcomed that action. Yet prominent Americans denounce it as a violation of international law, and insofar as their statements have any effect, the invocation of law in that case merely weakens the powers of the presidency. Now, the same sort of objections can be made to the War Powers Act, which is domestic. Well, it's not law exactly, but it's domestic something or other, which purports to control the president's use of military force. Now, it's widely known that the law has turned out to be, or the whatever it is, has turned out to be ineffective. And that's because presidents recognize the necessity to disregard key aspects of it for both policy and constitutional reasons. In particular, the last several presidents have declined to file reports, as the act says they should, of the introduction of U.S. armed forces into hostilities. That's under Section 4A1. And only a report filed under that section triggers the 60-day clock in 5B, which is the resolution, the act's main enforcement mechanism. The president is supposed to pull the troops out at the end of 60 days unless Congress has approved his action. So that by refusing to file under 4A1, presidents prevent the 60-day clock from starting to run. Now, Congress could require a president to withdraw troops by passing a concurrent resolution under Section 5C of the Act, but Congress has turned out to be reluctant to do that. For one thing, the Act was designed to control the president without requiring any action by Congress with respect to a particular use of force. It's kind of like the congressional pay hike, which is supposed to achieve results without Congress having to do anything. Congress has always had the power to constrain the president's use of military force through its appropriations power. But it has been reluctant to do that in the past, and it's hardly surprising that it's also reluctant to pass concurrent resolutions that would require the president to withdraw. Now, these types of presidential use of force abroad without congressional approval, except approval through the appropriations process, has a long history going back to President Jefferson's unilateral retaliatory attack on the Barbary Pirates. And the need for presidents to have that power, particularly in the modern age, should be obvious to almost anyone. In this respect, the War Powers Resolution is ineffective because it seeks to involve Congress in something it is institutionally incapable of handling. That is the swift response with military force to attacks on American citizens or American interests abroad. The fact that the resolution is bound to be ineffective as a protection against a president determined to enmesh us in a war is particularly well illustrated by the fact that the president must have unilateral authority, as everybody concedes, to use our nuclear arsenal if necessary on a few minutes' notice. If Congress and the American people are willing to entrust that kind of power to one man, it seems hard to see a danger that can be effectively guarded against by the War Powers Act when Congress does have the power of the purse to control actions there. In addition to being ineffective, the War Powers Resolution is also proved to be unwise because it has adverse foreign policy effects. That's what President Nixon said when he vetoed the act. He warned that the act would send an unclear signal to our allies and would suggest that we were unreliable, since we would find it hard under the act to act quickly in a crisis. Undoubtedly, the mere existence of this act has complicated the efforts of the executive branch attempting to respond to communist infiltration in Central America. The attempts of congressional Democrats to invoke the resolution, and some Republicans, to force, for example, President Reagan to withdraw our armed forces from Lebanon and the Persian Gulf, also suggests how threatening the act can be to the lives of American servicemen in the field. The existence of the resolution and the debates in Congress about whether to invoke the act must have emboldened enemy forces in both of those instances. And it may be noteworthy that in the 15 years the act has been in effect, our foreign policy has been less bipartisan than it once was. It also, I must say, the act has the effect of making the Congress less accountable to the American people. Because it has the effect of allowing Congress to remain silent. Once a conflict begins, they can wait and see how popular the action is before deciding whether or not to invoke the War Powers Act. Thus means that the act, without any usable enforcement mechanism, becomes a tool to use against the president whenever uses of military force turn out after the fact to have been unpopular. Whatever the policy arguments in favor of repealing the War Powers Act, there is nothing compared to the constitutional arguments against it. First, the act purports to define the constitutional balance of power by statute. That is, it attempts to define the separation of powers in this area by statute. And that can't be done. Wherever the line lies between Congress's constitutional authority to declare war and the president's constitutional authority as commander-in-chief and main actor in our foreign policy, that line cannot be affected to the slightest degree by a mere statute. Thus, the 60-day limit on whatever inherent authority the president has to deploy troops without a declaration of war has to be unconstitutional. Either the president has such inherent authority, in which case Congress cannot limit his use of it, or he lacks it, and Congress cannot delegate its war-making power to the president for a period of 60 days. The one result that the Constitution surely does not allow is the one that is prescribed by the statute. Now, there are a lot of other things to be said about it. For example, the statute lists all of the occasions upon which the president may use force abroad without first getting a declaration of war from Congress. And of course, the declaration of war by Congress is something that we have wanted to avoid in many circumstances in which Congress actually approved of presidential use of force, because a declaration of war triggers treaties and also has an impact internationally that often the United States does not want to have. But in any event, the list of circumstances which are said to be exclusive in which the president can unilaterally use force does not allow, for example, for the use of force in a whole range of situations where it has traditionally been allowed, including rescues and protection from terrorist attack. In sum, aside from its policy failings, the resolution seems unconstitutional, as President Nixon said in his veto message, and as President Bush has said in some speeches. It was my position at the time, not communicated to the president, but I thought at the time, that when the War Powers Act was presented to him, President Nixon should not have vetoed it, because that makes what is essentially a legal nullity look like a real law. He should have sent the resolution back to Congress with a message saying, thank you very much for your opinion of my constitutional powers. When I have the time, I will send you an essay on my opinion of my constitutional powers. Now, there is clearly a need for consultation between Congress and the President on any use of force overseas. And Congress clearly has the last word to order the end to the use of force overseas simply by withholding any appropriations. But there's a need for consultation. As President Bush said in his inaugural address, our foreign policy cannot possibly succeed without some degree of bipartisanship. The problem with the War Powers Act is that it is a clumsy mechanism for accomplishing that outcome. In fact, no president can succeed in foreign policy without congressional appropriations and therefore without public support. Even Ronald Reagan, with extraordinary popularity, failed to achieve in Nicaragua what he accomplished in Afghanistan and Angola because he could not rally public support to the Nicaraguan policy. Now, the War Powers Act was no more helpful in facilitating the successful cooperation between the branches that made our policy work in Afghanistan than it was responsible for restraining President Reagan in Nicaragua. It becomes essentially, the act becomes ineffective, but it essentially is a vehicle for recrimination against the president as a law violator. And to that extent, it is another rhetorical vehicle that allows Congress to move more and more into the details of the management of foreign affairs and the use of force. And thus it represents, I think, an incursion, a breakdown in the constitutional scheme of the separation of powers. Now, it is said in the newspapers that President Bush is looking for a case in which he can get courts to rule that some presidential powers, I think including in this area, have been invaded by Congress in an unconstitutional fashion. If that is true, I hope he rethinks the policy, because in the first place, from a purely pragmatic point of view, the courts are not a reliable ally of the president, even when the president is right, as was shown in the independent counsel case, the Morrison case. And in the second place, if Congress should not move into the president's area of constitutional authority, an authority which he has because of the very different capacities of the two institutions of the executive and the legislature, if Congress should not move into that, certainly the courts shouldn't move in to decide the issue. Courts cannot really write a body of law to control future actions by the president any more than the Congress can. And it is probably, the courts are probably a less appropriate institution to make that attempt, even than Congress is. So I end by saying to this group, which is devoted to the rule of law, that we ought to recognize that there are areas of life in which law laid down in advance does more harm than good and represents an invasion of the necessary powers of the president to use force and to deploy troops abroad. It is a breakdown in that, to that extent, in the separation of powers. And we ought to recognize that we're talking on the international scene, where not everybody is subject to the same law, that the debate ought to be conducted not in legalisms, but in terms, as I say, of national interest, of prudence, and of our version of morality. And if we do not think that a Republican form of government is superior to autocratic or tyrannical regimes, and therefore that our morality justifies actions such as Grenada, Panama, then we've entered a period of moral relativism in these matters, which we ought not to. And in the future, as these debates go forward, reflect that appeals to law in these areas are really digressions from what is really at stake. Thank you.
We have a few more minutes for questions, so that if you'd like to use the two microphones on either side. Yes.
Yes, Judge Bork, while I'm in general accord with many of your frustrations about international law as prescribed by scholars and the international community of charlatans and dictators, I have to ask you whether you would have the same views about deeming equivalent our international morality with what we will consider international law, whether if the United States were not the ascendant power in the world, and whether if we were not in a position to dictate terms and situations and project our power so well, whether we would be so comfortable saying that one's morality is one's law if Libya were in a position to say that this is our morality and this invasion of ours is okay in international law, whether you would have the same view.
I would have the same view. I would be very unhappy. The fact is that the invocation of international law seems to stop nobody. Insofar as it has an effect, it has an adverse effect upon Western democracies, where the charge of violation of international law is freely made and believed by many people, so that it affects a lowering of our morale to the degree that we are not sure whether these charges of law violation have substance or not. Dictatorial nations do not have that problem. They are rarely charged internally with violations of international law, except when it serves their purpose to be so charged. So that I think international law is utterly ineffective, except as a propaganda weapon. And for that reason, I just, in this area of use of force, and for that reason, I think we ought to think about what is really at stake, which, as I say, is our national interest, the interest of other allies of ours, and the interest of the people against, as in Panama and in Grenada, the interest of the local populations, so that we can ask ourselves whether what we are doing we can justify morally. You can certainly justify it legally, but you can also attack it legally. International law is so indeterminate it rests upon this proposition that promises are to be kept unless circumstances have changed, which means that there is never any firm answer to in any case.
Judge Bork, I have one problem. It seems to be an inconsistency with what's being said today. It seems you're saying that the Congress can use the Appropriations Clause to restrict the president's use of military power. In a panel before this, Professor Miller of Chicago said it was a lamentable use of the Appropriations Clause by the Congress to restrict the president's use of military power. Secondly, part of the question, what is your response? Was the Congress correct in the Boland Amendment, or was it not? Was the Iran-Contra hearings of the Congress right about Iran-Contra, or they're not?
Well, when I say use the appropriations process, at least that requires Congress to step up and make a decision about what it wants and what it doesn't want. And my objection, and that's law, that's all right. It may use it unwisely, but that's law and that's all right. My objection is to trying to lay down in the War Powers Act a whole series of conditions for future and unknown events, which turn out to be utterly inappropriate when unexpected events occur. And to a Congress which, by laying down those rules, then can excuse itself from trying to control the president when he does something in particular. It can lie there and wait and not exercise responsibility. The Boland amendments, I think there were several of them. As I recall, they were quite vague, many of them. And they produced a vacillating policy with respect to Nicaragua and the Contras. I think they were most unwise, constitutionally better than the War Powers Act. That's not great praise.
Your Honor, I'd like to ask a question on impoundment, particularly in light of the separation of powers jurisprudence since you were Solicitor General. Supposing the Congress enacts a statute over the President's veto, appropriating $5 million for the construction of a consulate in the state of Andropov, and secondly, mandates that this expenditure be made immediately. Would the President be entitled to forbid this expenditure as being unconstitutional? And if he did so, bearing in mind your opinion in the Vantage Act case, should that question be justiciable if brought by a member of Congress?
Well, no, it should not be justiciable if brought by a member of Congress, because I don't think the doctrine of congressional standing is entirely an invention of the D.C. Circuit. That's not the reason it's wrong. The doctrine of congressional standing, whereby congressmen sue the president in courts to fight out the disputes between them, really brings courts to a position of power and control of the whole scheme of government, which was never intended by the framers of the Constitution. But now, if somebody else sued, who was denied money because of what the president did, and therefore would have standing, the fact is the impoundment weapon of the president's hasn't proved too effective. When I was Solicitor General, took on the impoundment issue, because President Nixon was then trying to use impoundment. And I devised a very complex and clever strategy by which I would not appeal some cases, would appeal others, and would work the impoundment issue to the Supreme Court in stages, giving them the easy case first. The easy case got there. I lost 9-0. I think you can give up on impoundment. Forrest Montgomery did suggest that the president did have a power not to expend all funds appropriated, because an appropriation is not a mandate to spend. I can't give you the details of that argument. I hope he's here, because he can. But in any event, that kind of dispute should not get into courts unless there is a party with a monetary stake in it to bring it.
Okay.
I may expire, but go ahead.
Judge Bork, I'm intrigued by the few words that you said about the error of President Bush's ways of looking for a case in which to test various inherent powers. Of course, it's entirely possible for cases about, as the previous question suggested, for cases about the inherent powers of the president to reach court without the president's connivance, cooperation, or desire. President Bush may take your advice, and yet a court may one day find itself called upon to decide the constitutionality of the War Powers Resolution, or more important for your remarks, the constitutionality of a particular use of force abroad. Assuming that should happen, and assuming that the decision were adverse to the president, would your view that the courts have no business writing codes in this area suggest that the president should simply ignore that judicial decision?
I'm sorry for this. No, I don't think so. Our legal culture, it may be that it would have been as well if we had developed some understanding of when presidents can ignore court decisions. But in our legal culture, the answer seems to be never. Now, a friend of mine once posed a hypothetical. He said, when the South Carolina proposed to secede from the Union, and then other states followed, suppose a way had been found, and I suppose a way could be found, to get the question of secession into the Supreme Court. There is no more quintessentially constitutional an issue than whether a state can leave the Union. And suppose the case had gone against the United States, as it might very well have with that court. Well, it was the court that had produced, pretty much the court that had produced Dred Scott. I don't think any of us would think that President Lincoln should have been bound by that. And yet, I don't know how to generalize that into a principle. One more.
Judge Bork, if I could ask you to return to the question of law versus morality for a moment, using Panama as an example. You mentioned a few times that we agree that a Republican form of government is superior to an authoritarian form of government. It seemed to suggest that that itself were justification for the invasion. I would have thought that most everyone agrees with that principle, but that the critics of the invasion argue that it is proper not for another sovereign nation to invade another one, but to let the people of Panama work it out themselves. And that question and the debate over that question, although sometimes couched in legal terms, is understood by everyone to be essentially a moral question and a question that we have to discuss as a moral question about when we're going to use American force. And I'd just like you to comment on whether, in fact, it is perceived as that.
Well, if there were no pretense that there is a known body of international law, which is law, and for which people may be condemned, if only morally, but may be condemned for violation of it, violating it, then I would have no concern if we understood that it was not law in the usual sense. But the precise reason that presidents are attacked on international law grounds is very often that the attacker does not wish to attack on moral grounds an action which has proved very popular. And it's a way of avoiding the substance of the issue and intruding legalisms which really have nothing to do with it. Have I answered your question?
Well, I was just curious whether you think that the debate that actually followed the invasion of Panama in this country, at least in the press and in general conversation, was a legalistic debate, or whether, in fact, people who were raising questions about the invasion were raising fundamentally moral questions about our power and right to invade the country.
Well, I think a lot of it was legal, but it's a little hard to raise a moral question when the Panamanian people, by well over 90%, were delighted with what we did, unless we don't think that what the people of a country want is of importance. And I do think so. Thank you all very much.